KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Questa nostra casa si sta rovinando.
Our house is going to ruin. And that harms everyone, especially the poorest. Mine is therefore an appeal for responsibility, based on the task that God has given to man in creation, till and keep the garden, in which he was placed. I invite everyone to accept with open hearts this document, which follows the Church's social doctrine.
As preparations begin for Pope Francis's Saturday funeral, we mark this Earth Day by looking at the Pope's climate legacy and his landmark 2015 encyclical that called for the world to make sweeping changes to protect what he called our common home. Then to the lawyer of Rumeysa Öztürk, the Tufts doctoral student recently abducted by masked federal agents. A judge has ordered her to be transferred from an immigration jail in Louisiana to Vermont. Then 70 years ago this week, the historic 1955 anti-colonial Bandung Conference was held in Indonesia. We'll speak to Vijay Prashad.
70 years ago, 29 new countries from India all the way out to Egypt, from Africa and Asia, came to Bandung, Indonesia to demand that a new world be built. I mean, what a glorious challenge to come and say, let's build a new world. You can't say they didn't try. They tried really, really hard. The fact that they didn't fully succeed has to do with neocolonialism, not with their ambitions. Their ambitions are alive and well today.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A group of four Democratic lawmakers arrived in El Salvador Monday to continue to push for the release of Kilmer Abrego Garcia, the Maryland father who remains detained at CECAT, the mega prison, where he was transferred in what the Trump administration admitted was an administrative error. The delegation was led by Democratic representatives Yasemin Ansari of Arizona, Maxine Dexter of Oregon, Maxwell Frost of Florida, and Robert Garcia of California. The group spoke from the capital, San Salvador. This is Congressmember Frost.
This isn't just about him. This is also about every single person in the United States. The Constitution applies to all people in our country. Due process applies to all people in our country. It's one of the things that sets our country apart from other places across the entire world. And so we're worried, of course, we demand the release of Abrego Garcia, but we're also worried about our own constituents.
This comes as the relatives of Venezuelan immigrants jailed at the Bluebonnet ICE jail in Texas are fighting for their release after the U.S. Supreme Court temporarily blocked the Trump administration from expelling them to El Salvador's mega prison under the Alien Enemies Act of 1798. This is the brother of 28-year-old Jonathan Betancourt, one of the men at risk of being sent to CECAT.
My fear is that they might unjustly take him there because my brother is not a criminal. He just has tattoos. He's a barber, and tattoos are an art for young people, as well as coloring their hair. He has no criminal record, neither in Venezuela nor in the United States, thank God.
Meanwhile, a federal judge in Colorado may extend a temporary restraining order preventing Trump officials from sending two Venezuelan asylum seekers to El Salvador. The men are currently jailed at the Aurora ICE Processing Center. One of them came to the U.S. fleeing political persecution, while the other left Venezuela after two of his relatives were killed by members of the Tren del Agua gang. But the Trump administration is now accusing them, without evidence, of being members of that gang. One of the asylum seekers has a single tattoo depicting his niece's name. The other has tattoos that include his mother's name, his birth year, and a character from the board game Monopoly. Here in New York, a group of students and alumni chained themselves to the gates of Columbia University Monday, demanding the release of Palestinian student activists Mahmoud Khalil and Mohsen Mahdawi. The two are in ICE jails, one in Louisiana, the other in Vermont, and fighting deportation proceedings after they helped organize Columbia campus protests in solidarity with Gaza. On Monday, Mahmoud Khalil's wife, Dr. Noor Abdullah, said she'd given birth to the couple's first child in New York while her husband remained imprisoned at the Louisiana jail over 1,000 miles away. ICE denied Khalil's request to be present at the birth. In a statement, Noor Abdullah wrote, quote, "My son and I should not be navigating his first days on earth without Mahmoud. ICE and the Trump administration have stolen these precious moments from our family in an attempt to silence Mahmoud's support for Palestinian freedom," unquote. Noor Abdullah is a U.S. citizen. Mahmoud Khalil is a U.S. green card holder until the Trump administration revoked that green card. Vermont Senator Peter Welch met Monday with detained Columbia student Mohsen Mahdawi, a green card holder from Palestine who was arrested in Vermont when he appeared for what he was told would be a naturalization test. Ahead of his arrest, Mahdawi helped lead campus protests against Israel's war on Gaza at Columbia University. Senator Welch, who's calling for Mahdawi's release, published a brief interview with Mahdawi he recorded inside the Northwest State Correctional Facility.
"I want to tell everyone that I feel so loved and so supported. And I am here in good hands. I am centered, I am clear, I am grounded. And I don't want you to worry about me. I want you to continue working for the democracy of this country and for humanity. The war must stop."
He was sitting next to Senator Welch in the jail as he spoke. A federal judge in Georgia has temporarily ordered the Trump administration to reinstate the visas of at least 133 international students. Judge Victoria Marie Calvert's order would, for now, block the termination of their student visas while their lawsuit resolves in court. A similar suit challenging Trump's mass cancellation of student visas has also been filed in New Hampshire. The news site Higher Ed Dive reports the Trump administration has so far terminated the visas of more than 1,550 international students, putting them at risk of deportation. Many of them have been targeted for participating in Gaza solidarity protests on campus, while others have had their visas revoked over past minor offenses like traffic infractions. Israel's military has killed more Palestinian civilians in the Gaza Strip. Al Jazeera reports Israeli attacks have killed at least 25 Palestinians since dawn, including 11 people who burned to death inside their home in Khan Yunis after multiple air attacks triggered a fire. Earlier today, the head of the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees denounced Israel's siege of Gaza, which is now in its 51st day. Philippe Lazzarini said nearly 3,000 trucks carrying life-saving aid and basic supplies are prepared to cross into Gaza. He wrote, quote, "Humanitarian aid is being used as a bargaining chip and a weapon of war," unquote. In Sudan, more details have emerged following a rapid support forces attack on North Darfur Zamzam displacement camp last week, with survivors describing mass looting and the burning of homes as bullets rained down on civilians. RSF fighters captured the camp, killing at least 300 people and forcing another 400,000 to flee as they face famine. These are two of the survivors.
"There were people who died on this road because of thirst and hunger. Some people just died. Now, I don't know what's become of my mother, father, brother, siblings, and my grandmother. I came here with strangers. Thank God, I came with them."
"We are in need of everything a human needs, whether flour, rice, pasta, sugar, anything. Also blankets and covers to sleep on. We are sleeping on the bare ground."
RSF fighters have also reportedly placed checkpoints around Zamzam and other displacement camps in Darfur, leaving many without safe shelter or access to food and water. The Trump administration's cuts to U.S. foreign aid have exacerbated the humanitarian catastrophe, pushing thousands of civilians, including children, to the brink of starvation. Russian President Vladimir Putin has signaled he's open to ceasefire negotiations with Ukrainian leader Volodymyr Zelensky. It's the first time since the early stages of Russia's full-scale invasion that Putin has said he's open to bilateral talks with Ukraine. Putin's remarks came after another night of Russian attacks, including drone strikes in the Black Sea port city of Odessa, which reportedly injured three people and damaged several residences. The U.S. military is continuing its attacks on Yemen a day after Houthi media reported U.S. strikes killed 12 people in a market in the capital Sana'a. There were more U.S. attacks reported in recent hours in Sana'a, as well as the island of Kamaran in the Red Sea and in Yemen's central Ma'arib governorate. Houthi fighters claim to have fired on targets in Israel as well as on U.S. aircraft carriers in the Red Sea. President Trump's backing Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth after the former weekend Fox News host shared sensitive information about U.S. plans to strike Yemen in a group chat on the Signal app, this time with his wife and brother. It was the second such scandal in recent weeks. Speaking of the annual White House Easter egg roll, which this year was sponsored by Amazon, YouTube, and Meta, Trump dismissed the reports as fake news and a waste of money. Secretary Hegseth also spoke to reporters, accusing them of spreading lies.
This is where we're fighting hoaxsters, this group right here, full of hoaxsters that peddle anonymous sources from leakers with axes to grind, and then you put it all together as if it's some news story.
The Supreme Court appears poised to uphold the preventive care provision of the Affordable Care Act as justices heard arguments in a key health care case Monday. This comes as the Trump administration's planning to gut public health programs in its new budget, imposing a $40 billion cut to the Health and Human Services Department. The administration's proposal, which must be approved by Congress, would also consolidate a number of health department functions under Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s new Administration for a Healthy America, or AHA. Among the proposed cuts are programs addressing gun violence, youth violence prevention, minority health, and rural health initiatives. Connecticut Democrat Rosa DeLauro warned the Trump administration's proposal would, quote, surrender Americans to preventable disease and premature death, she said. Meanwhile, the National Institutes of Health announced it'll pull federal research funding from universities that have any diversity, equity, and inclusion programs or are involved in boycotts of Israeli companies. Harvard University is suing the Trump administration after it froze over $2 billion in federal grants for the Ivy League institution. The freeze came after Harvard refused to comply with the White House's order on eliminating DEI, being involved with admissions at the school, and further suppressing pro-Palestinian protests. Harvard's president, Alan Garber, said the cuts would affect key research on pediatric cancer, veterans' health, infectious disease, as well as Alzheimer's and Parkinson's disease. Garber warned, quote, the consequences of the government's overreach will be severe and long-lasting. The Education Department says it'll start garnishing wages and Social Security benefits for student loans that are in default starting May 5th. The policy shift could affect over 5 million borrowers, with another 4 million at risk of being in default in the coming months. It would be the first time the federal government would collect on the loan since repayments were paused in 2020 during the pandemic. The New York Times is reporting the Trump administration soliciting ideas from right-wing think tanks like the Heritage Foundation to help boost the U.S. birth rate. The proposals shared with the White House include a $5,000 cash payment after having a baby, ways to address infertility, and creating a National Medal of Motherhood for women who have six or more children. The so-called pronatalist movement is supported by Vice President J.D. Vance and Elon Musk, who has 14 or more children. The push comes even as the White House and the Republican Party are weighing cuts to Medicaid, which covers 2 out of 5 U.S. children. Democratic House Whip Catherine Clark responded on social media, quote, this isn't complicated. Number one, affordable child care. Number two, paid family leave. Number three, stop trying to slash health care for women and kids, unquote. The Vatican's announced the funeral for Pope Francis will take place Saturday in what's expected to be a scaled-down ceremony at his request. The Vatican says Pope Francis's death Monday at the age of 88 was due to a stroke and heart failure. We'll have more on Pope Francis on this Earth Day and his legacy as a champion of the environment after headlines. Back in the United States, a federal judge has issued a preliminary injunction ordering Trump's State Department to allow six transgender and non-binary people to obtain U.S. passports with sex designations that match their gender identity. For now, the order only applies to the six plaintiffs who plan to file a motion that would extend the protections to all impacted trans and non-binary people. The measure was among a series of anti-trans executive orders issued by President Trump on his first day back in office. The State Department since suspended the processing of passports for people who indicate their sex as X on their applications. In London, thousands of transgender and non-binary people, joined by their allies, gathered in Parliament Square over the weekend as protests continue following the United Kingdom's unanimous Supreme Court ruling declaring the definition of a woman does not include trans women who will no longer be protected under Britain's Equality Act. This is one of the protesters.
Cis people need to start rallying and understanding that transphobia doesn't just hurt transgender people. They are policing women, they're policing femininity, they're policing how we look. And we can't allow that.
And a clarification to our top headline. The Trump administration now says deported Maryland father Kilmer Abrego Garcia was moved to another prison in El Salvador after he was first held at the notorious CICOT mega prison. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
The Vatican's announced the funeral for Pope Francis will take place Saturday in what is expected to be a scaled-down ceremony. In his will, Pope Francis asked to be buried in what he called a simple tomb at St. Mary Major Basilica. Cardinals around the world are heading to the Vatican for the funeral and then to pick the Pope's successor. Pope Francis died Monday at the age of 88 of stroke and heart failure. He made his last public appearance on Easter Sunday when he repeated his call for a ceasefire in Gaza. Today, on this Earth Day, we look at Pope Francis's long record calling for action on the climate crisis. On Monday, the top United Nations official on climate change, Simon Steele, remembered Pope Francis as a, quote, towering figure of human dignity and an unflinching global champion of climate action, unquote. In 2015, the Pope issued a groundbreaking papal letter, or encyclical, on the climate crisis, where he wrote, quote, the climate is a common good, belonging to all and meant for all. The Pope openly criticized the role of wealthy nations in causing the climate crisis, writing, quote, the idea of infinite or unlimited growth, which proves so attractive to economists, financiers, and experts in technology, is based on the lie that there is an infinite supply of the Earth's goods, and this leads to the planet being squeezed dry at every limit, he said. In 2015, Pope Francis made a plea to address the climate crisis when he spoke at the White House.
When it comes to the care of our common home, we are living at a critical moment of history. We still have time to make the change needed to bring about a sustainable and integral development, for we know that things can change. Such change demands on our part a serious and responsible recognition, not only of the kind of the world we may be leaving to our children, but also to the millions of people living under a system which has overlooked them.
That was Pope Francis speaking in 2015. We're joined now by Nathan Schneider, professor of media studies at the University of Colorado Boulder, also a contributing writer at America Magazine, a national Catholic weekly magazine published by the Jesuits, where he's been covering Catholic engagement with climate change and the economy. Nathan Schneider, welcome back to Democracy Now! It's beautiful to see that mountainous backdrop. As we once again talk about the Pope, who died on Monday, he was the first Latin American Pope. He was the first Jesuit Pope. If you can first, before we get into the environment, talk about the significance of his reign.
Thank you for having me. It's good to be with you again. Pope Francis's papacy is a historic moment in the time in the history of the church, something that I hope will be a beginning rather than now in his passing an end. It was a return in many respects to, I think, the heart of the gospel and the heart of the Christian message, which is simplicity and humility and a call for peace and for love and solidarity among people.
And Nathan, can you talk about the significance of his encyclical on the climate and this critique of what's accepted wisdom in modern society, that economic, technological advancement and economic growth are the key to nations being prosperous?
Absolutely. You know, when I first read this document, Laudato Si, when it came out, I remember tears coming to my eyes because of the force of the way in which he brought together the riches of Christian and Catholic tradition to bear with the prophetic work of social movements around the world in confronting a global crisis that we're facing and that so many of the elites in the world we live in today are determined to ignore or, you know, outright worsen. His message was, again, drawing on the prophetic messages of social movements, recognized that the climate crisis is not merely an environmental crisis. It's not merely about the things other than the human. It is deeply intertwined with justice in our human world, and justice for the poor, that the poor are the people who suffer the most from climate change, and the wealthy are those who are most responsible for perpetrating it. And so this idea that is central to the encyclical, the idea of integral ecology, is about insisting on that connection, insisting that justice with the earth, our relationship with the earth, depends on justice among people, and that in order to address this environmental crisis, we need to also address the crisis of disposability, of treating not only the planet but each other as disposable, and that when we see these two together, we actually recognize not just that we've been bad, that we've done bad things, but actually there are so many things we can do. One of my favorite lines in Laudato Si is this exclamation he makes that truly much can be done. And he says that because he'd been watching social movements around the world, building cooperatives, building economic alternatives, using renewable energy, building sustainable alternatives to the dominant paradigm, and so it's really a document of hope above all, and it's that hope that was his overriding spirit.
And I'm wondering also, much has been made of the fact that he was the first pope from the global south, but he was also the first Jesuit pope. And could you talk a little bit in terms of the history of the Jesuits within the Catholic Church? Of course, historically, they were expelled during the colonial era, the early colonial era, from the Americas.
You know, the Jesuits have a long history, but throughout that history, they've been a missionary order, going to the far reaches of the world, and in the process, learning from the world. One thing that Pope Francis talked about a lot was the peripheries, trying to turn the church outward to learning from the experience of people, not just in Rome, not just in Europe, but in Latin America, in the Philippines, in the places that that are often most vulnerable to the injustices of our world. He brought people from the Amazon to share their wisdom and their experience with faith in Rome. And so over and over, he was seeing the peripheries as a source of truth, not just the center of the church. And that is a kind of outgrowth of this long legacy of Jesuits going out to the far reaches of the world, learning the cultures that they found themselves among, and developing a kind of respect, developing an understanding of the Catholic faith that is not just one person talking to another, telling another what to do, but actually learning from our encounter with one another, recognizing that our faith is an experience of ongoing revelation.
I want to go back to Pope Francis in his own words. He spoke to CBS host Norm O'Donnell last year about the climate crisis. His remarks were voiced over.
Climate change at this moment is a road to death. A road to death, eh? And it is an artificial climate change, no? Something provoked, not the normal climate change, right?
You have placed blame on wealthy countries.
In great measure, yes, because they are the ones that have more of an economy and an energy based on fossil fuels that are creating the situation, right? They are the countries that can make the most difference, given their industry and all, aren't they? But it is very difficult to create an awareness of this. They hold a conference, everybody is in agreement, they all sign, and then bye-bye.
So that was the Pope several years ago. When President Trump saw him, he saw him only once, I think it was in 2017, the Pope presented Trump with a copy of that climate encyclical from 2015, very much interpreted as an attempt by the Pope to encourage Trump to take on the issue in a different way. Of course, the mantra of the Trump administration is drill, baby, drill. And the Pope is very direct about the connection between capitalism and the destruction of the environment. Can you elaborate further, Nathan?
Absolutely. You know, and I think it's really important to, you know, see these two figures together at this moment where we're losing one and one is very much on the rise. You know, one thing that Francis was deeply concerned about was the building of walls. Building walls higher, which was, of course, Trump's initial platform in coming to office back in 2016, 2017, and continues to be the kind of logic of his approach to governance. Francis wrote, for instance, another letter in 2020, Fratelli Tutti, calling for people to find solidarity across lines. He saw capitalism and militarism and the militarized borders as all part of a common turn away from the solidarity that we are called for, the love for one another that should be our aim, even if we can't always practice it perfectly, to at least make it the aim in our lives. And he saw the outgrowth of migrant crises in Europe and in the United States, where people are seeking migration just to be able to have a chance at life for themselves and their families, as intertwined with a climate crisis that is driving people to move from one place to another. And he called over and over for an approach to our politics in our own countries built on solidarity, as well as a solidarity that crosses borders. In many respects, I think he was an iconoclast in the sense of taking down the idols of our world. The idols, the things that we think are real that really aren't. the borders that are built around imaginary lines, the rules of capitalism that encourage us to privilege financial returns over human good and the cry of the poor, as he so often put it. So for him, the Christian message is above all a call to take down the idols and to see the opportunities for love and for solidarity that are actually right in front of us.
Nathan, briefly, the issue of his encyclical on climate being directed not just at members of the church, but he said that the protecting the planet is a moral and ethical imperative for believers and non-believers alike. The importance of his addressing people of other faiths as well in that encyclical.
Absolutely. He addressed that encyclical, as you said, to all people of the world. And one thing that is evident in the encyclical as well and in his other writings is the way in which he's listening to people of the world, not just Catholics. So he's quoting people in the encyclical who are not just Catholic leaders, but recognizing that the Catholic social teaching can learn from everybody, and that he wanted to enter into a dialogue with people of the world. And in some respects, that message was heard better outside of the Catholic Church than inside. There are still many contexts where Catholics are resisting this call to ecological conversion and to an integral ecology, as he put it, where Catholics are caught up in the very patterns of environmental destruction and social injustice that he was calling out. And I think he knew that this is a challenge and a task that would require more than just, you know, the flock that he shepherds. And I think that's a very Christian thing to do. You know, Jesus in his ministry often went to the peripheries, reached outside of the Jewish people, spoke to people and learned from people and held up people who were not part of his particular social group. And that's something that I think Francis is echoing in turning to a dialogue with the world, recognizing that that in some respects his own people are part of the problem.
Very quickly, 30 seconds, the successors who are being talked about, you know, the conclave will decide. You've got two front runners from the Philippines, among them Luis Antonio Tego, Pietro Parlin of Italy, Peter Turkson, Ghana, front runner from Hungary, and another from Italy. Your thoughts on where this goes?
You know, it's a complex process, and I don't claim any special insight in it. But I do think this is a really critical moment for moral leadership in the world at a time where we are tempted to put up more walls among our people and among countries, that the selection of this next pope will be, you know, could be a turning point in deciding whether we as a, you know, as a species turn toward solidarity or build our walls even higher.
Nathan Schneider, we thank you so much for being with us, professor of media studies at the University of Colorado Boulder. We'll link to your articles in America Magazine, National Catholic Magazine, published by the Jesuits. Long been covering Catholic engagement with climate change and the economy. Co-editor of the book Beautiful Solutions, A Toolbox for Liberation. Next up, we speak with a lawyer for Rumeysa Öztürk, the Tufts doctoral student who is abducted by masked federal agents and ultimately sent to Louisiana. Judges ordered her to be transferred to Vermont. Stay with us. Good Name by William Onyebar. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. A federal judge has ordered the Turkish national Tufts University PhD student Rumeysa Öztürk to be transferred to Vermont no later than May 1st as she seeks to challenge what her lawyers call her unconstitutional detention in an ICE jail in Louisiana. That order came Friday and followed a separate hearing last Wednesday when an immigration judge denied bond for Rumeysa, declaring her to be a potential so-called danger to the community. Rumeysa, who is from Turkey, was arrested for co-authoring a student op-ed on Tufts' response to Gaza solidarity protests on campus. Rumeysa Öztürk is a doctoral candidate in the school's Department of Child Study and Human Development and research assistant at Tufts Children's Television Project. She's a former Fulbright scholar. On March 25th, masked, plainclothes immigration agents snatched her from the streets of Somerville, Massachusetts, outside Tufts. Surveillance video from a nearby house shows agents approaching her on the streets near her home. In the video, you can hear her scream as the agents move to detain her. Apparently, she said something like, I'm calling the police, and they said something like, they are the police. The Washington Post reports the State Department found no evidence linking Rumeysa Öztürk to anti-Semitic activities or public statements in support of terrorism. The Washington Post reports a State Department memo determined Secretary of State Marco Rubio did not have sufficient grounds for revoking her visa, contradicting public accusations made by the Trump administration. Meanwhile, the Tufts University Democrats and Republicans have released a joint statement condemning the Trump administration's arrest and detention of Rumeysa and its overall attack on international students and their right to free speech. As she awaits transfer to Vermont, Rumeysa's jailed at a privately run ICE jail in Louisiana. For more, we're joined by one of Rumeysa's attorneys, Madaso Tapa, staff attorney at CLEAR, a legal nonprofit clinic at CUNY School of Law. Madaso, welcome to Democracy Now! Can you explain exactly what happened? This is all also happening as another judge ruled that something like 130 international students have to have their visas reinstated.
Yes, thank you, Amy, for having me. So there's two parallel tracks in Ms. Öztürk's case. There's the immigration proceedings that you mentioned that involved this bond proceeding that happened last Wednesday, where the immigration judge found that based on this one paragraph memo from the State Department that says that you know, the only evidence that's cited is this op-ed that she co-authored that references a common cause with an organization that was later temporarily banned from campus. As supporting a finding that she was a danger to her community or a flight risk. And so those proceedings are happening on a parallel track to the habeas proceedings that are happening in federal court. And Ms. Öztürk's initial petition was filed in the District Court of Massachusetts. That was eventually transferred to the District of Vermont because at the time that petition was filed, that's where she was. The court heard arguments on the government's motion to dismiss and our motion for bail and for Ms. Öztürk's release. And this last Friday, the court rejected the government's arguments and held that it did have jurisdiction to hear her claims. And so Ms. Öztürk's transfer has now been ordered. She's been ordered to be transferred back to Vermont. And the court has also ordered a bail hearing to happen on May 9th and a hearing to hear the underlying merits of her habeas petition on May 22nd. And this is important, at least with respect to cases involving, you know, ideological retaliation against students for their advocacy for Palestinian human rights. This is the first federal court that's actually said it has jurisdiction to hear these claims and is moving on to that phase of the process. And with respect to, you know, the temporary restraining orders that have been handed down in other courts regarding visa revocations writ large. Those are happening not just in Georgia, but throughout the country. As far as I'm aware, I think there have been at least six TROs issued, and some of those have extended beyond just the individual plaintiffs in those cases.
And I wanted to ask you, this whole issue of her student visa being revoked on March 21st without even her knowledge, could you talk about that and the implications of that for other international students?
Yeah, it's really chilling, you know. So the same memo that the government submits in Ms. Ozturk's removal case, this one paragraph memo from the State Department, it has this underlined portion, and this is underlined by the government itself, that says, due to ongoing ICE operational security, this revocation will be silent. And this is completely abnormal. The government is normally going to notify students that there's been a revocation. Generally, revocations will take place because of, you know, some issues regarding, like, the student perhaps not maintaining a full course load, or a criminal offense that renders them unable to maintain their student status. So typically, students are given notice, and they're given the opportunity to pursue other avenues of relief, potentially, you know, seeking a different type of visa or self-deportation, or, you know, just leaving the country. In this case, the government was clear it was intending to abduct Ms. Ozturk. They didn't want her to know that her visa was revoked, and 4 days later, they did exactly what they planned and abducted her in broad daylight in a street on Massachusetts.
And could you talk about the role of a Canary Mission and others like it in essentially identifying for the government people that they should be deporting?
Yeah, and, you know, I think at this point there's been a clear connection that we can draw, right, from the doxing organizations, the pro-Israeli doxing organizations, and there is a clear doxing to deportation pipeline that's taking place. And in Ms. Ozturk's case, it's even more apparent, because Ms. Ozturk was not a known organizer or advocate for any cause, really. Ms. Ozturk's sole sort of publicly identifiable association to, you know, the movement against the genocide and the movement for Palestinian human rights was this co-authored op-ed in her school newspaper that was really just asking the university to respect the wishes and the vote of the student senate. You know, all of a sudden, in February of 2025, almost a year after she's co-written this op-ed, Canary Mission publishes a page on her, doxing her, and alleging that she's engaged in anti-Semitic behavior because of this co-authored op-ed. And less than a month later, she's abducted by ICE. And so it's very chilling that, you know, the government seems to be taking their marching orders from these private, you know, doxing organizations with mysterious funding and backing. And I think it underscores why the government's actions are you know, simply unconscionable.
Well, we'll continue to cover Ramesa's case, see if they will send her back to Vermont, where the masked agents drove her to before sending her to Louisiana. Badasar Tapa, thanks so much for being with us. One of the attorneys for Ramesa Ozturk, a staff attorney at CLEAR, a legal clinic at CUNY School of Law. Again, the Democrats and Republicans at Tufts sent a joint letter objecting to her treatment, as did Tufts University. Next up, 70 years ago this week, the historic anti-colonial Bandung Conference took place. We'll speak to Vijay Prashad in Chile. Stay with us.
We're in the same old brother. We're in the same. Shake one end, you're gonna rob the other. It's the same old brother.
Oh, Lordy looked down from his holy place. Said, Lordy me, what a sea of space. What's about to launch the human race? So he built him a boat for a mixed-up crew, with eyes of black and brown and blue. So that's how come that you and I got just one world with just one sky.
We're in the same boat, brother. We're in the same boat, brother. And if you shake one end, you're gonna rock the other. It's the same boat, brother.
We're in the same boat, brother, by Lead Belly. And speaking of music, on Friday, we'll be bringing you an extended interview with the great director Ryan Coogler, his new film, Just Out, Sinners. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As President Trump moves to upend the global trade system, we look back at a critical moment 70 years ago when 29 nations from Asia and Africa gathered in Bandung, Indonesia, for a historic anti-colonial conference. The 1955 Bandung Conference marked a critical moment that the peoples of colonial nations of the global south made their collective presence felt on the world stage. It marked the birth of what would later become the non-aligned movement in the midst of the Cold War. Key nations participating included India, China, Indonesia, Egypt, Burma, Pakistan, Vietnam, and Ceylon, now known as Sri Lanka. This is the Indonesian president at the time, Sukarno, speaking at Bandung.
This is the first intercontinental conference of colored peoples, so-called colored peoples, in the history of mankind. I am proud that my country is your host. It is a new departure in the history of the world that leaders of Asian and African peoples can meet together in their own countries to discuss and deliberate upon matters of common concern.
Malcolm X would later talk about the historic importance of the Bandung Conference.
At Bandung, all the nations came together. They were dark nations from Africa and Asia. Some of them were Buddhists. Some of them were Muslim. Some of them were Christian. Some of them were Confucianists. Some were atheists. Despite their religious differences, they came together. Some were communists, some were socialists, some were capitalists. Despite their economic and political differences, they came together. All of them were black, brown, red, or yellow. The number one thing that was not allowed to attend the Bandung Conference was the white man. He couldn't come. Once they excluded the white man, they found that they could get together. Once they kept him out, everybody else fell right in and fell in line. This is the thing that you and I have to understand. And these people who came together didn't have nuclear weapons. They didn't have jet planes. They didn't have all of the heavy armaments that the white man has, but they had unity.
Malcolm X, the 100th anniversary of his birth will be in May. We're joined now by Vijay Prashad, the director of Tricontinental Institute for Social Research. His latest newsletter is titled Waiting for a New Bandung Spirit. Vijay Prashad has written more than 40 books, including The Darker Nations, A People's History of the Third World, which was just published in Indonesia this week. His latest piece for Globetrotter is on BRICS and industrial development. He's joining us from Santiago, Chile. Vijay, welcome back to Democracy Now! Let's go back 70 years, talk about the significance of the Bandung Conference, how it came together, and what this meant for the world today.
You know, it's very interesting, Amy, that right after World War II, there was an enormous upsurge of political unrest in the former colonies in Asia and Africa. This unrest led by anti-colonial movements was taking place not only for freedom in their countries, but for freedom in each other's countries. So in India, even before India won its independence in August of 1947, they convened a conference called the Asian Relations Conference, which was for solidarity with the people of Indonesia. fighting against the Dutch. That was the spirit of the age. Hundreds of millions of people across Africa, across Asia, fighting against colonialism, fighting brutal colonial wars in Malaya, in Kenya, the so-called Mau Mau Rebellion. At this moment, they gathered in Bandung, Indonesia, beautiful city in Indonesia, under the leadership of President Sukarno, who had won a really courageous fight, first against Japanese imperialism and then the Dutch. They came together, and what's really remarkable is, as Malcolm X says, they came, communists like Chou En-lai came few years after the Chinese Revolution, but also Sir John Kotelawala of Ceylon, now Sri Lanka, a absolute anti-communist. I mean, they all gathered together because they understood that their unity was very important, not only to create a new trade and development order, that was not the only part, but also to fight for peace, because they understood what it meant to live on the other side of a rifle. They understood that if the Cold War was allowed to metastasize, it would just not allow them to develop. So the watchwords from Bandung were peace and development. And these people who came there, Nehru, Nasser, Sukarno, Chou En-lai, they represented vast movements from around the world. They were not afraid of the people. They walked from their hotel to the conference venue. There were no armed guards. They met the people. They were greeted with cheers, and they gave powerful speeches, not only of unity, as Malcolm X points out, but also to say that, look, we don't have nuclear weapons, but we have the moral force of the anti-colonial movement, and that's what we're putting before the world. We want to change the world, make it a better place. We don't want the force of guns to rule over us any longer.
And Vijay, I wanted to ask you, you mentioned some of the leaders who were there, but interestingly, many of those leaders within a few years were either overthrown, for instance, Sukarno in 1965, and Nkrumah, and Nasser, and even on the way to the conference, there was an assassination attempt against Chou En-lai. The plane that he was scheduled to take to the conference was bombed and out of the air. Luckily, Chou En-lai supposedly had to postpone taking that plane because of an illness. But could you talk about how much the Western powers were in fear of what was developing as a result of Bandung?
It's very important to know that when you read the U.S. government documents, John Foster Dulles and others were quite furious with what was happening at Bandung. They refused to call this a non-aligned process. They insisted on calling them neutralists, saying that these people are in fact pro-communist, completely mischaracterizing the difference of political opinion at Bandung. And this attack at Bandung, really takes on a vicious form when it comes to the coups in the early to mid 1960s. It's important for people to remember that there was a trinity of coup d'etats in the 1960s against progressive governments in the largest countries in Africa, South America, and in Asia. First, the coup against Patrice Lumumba. Lumumba was, in a very real sense, the descendant of Nkrumahism, of the belief in Pan-Africanism of Kwame Nkrumah, comes to power in the largest country in Africa, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, is overthrown in a brutal coup led by the United States, the Belgians, the British intelligence services, and so on. That's in 1961. It destabilizes the National Liberation Movement in Africa, followed 3 years later by a coup d'etat against the liberal president, elected president of Brazil, Juan Goulart, in 1964, a coup that lasts 21 years, where the military in Brazil is then authorized through Operation Condor to effectively utilize military services across Latin America to cut down the impact of the Cuban Revolution of 1959. And that's the process that leads to the coup in Chile in 73, in Argentina in 76, and so on. Again, the largest country in Latin America, a coup pushed by the United States. And finally, 10 years after Bandung, as you rightly said, the coup d'etat against Sukarno, a million communists killed, often with faxes, telexes sent by the Australian intelligence services, British and United States, names of people that they wanted the military in Indonesia to execute, a million people killed, the progressive government of Sukarno overthrown. This has a huge impact in Asia. Bandung represented hope for the hundreds of millions of people around the planet in 1955. It was to crush that hope that the United States and its allies conducted these coups against Lumumba, Gulat, and then Sukarno.
And what is your sense, you've written now, in terms of the spirit of Bandung and what the situation is for the countries of the Global South? Now, you talked also about BRICS quite a bit in the last few years.
I mean, you know, it's interesting, Juan, because at the time of Bandung, the subjective or the consciousness of the need for a new change, for unity, for this moral force called the Third World, this was extremely high. But this sense, this consciousness of the need for change was far greater than the ability of these states. You know, these states were outclassed when it came to military power. These states simply didn't have the kind of wealth, technological capacity. In fact, they couldn't produce most things by themselves. You know, Walter Rodney will write later in How Europe Underdeveloped Africa that most African countries at the time of their independence were not able to produce toothpaste because they had to import it from Lever Brothers, from a British multinational corporation. These countries were at an objective disadvantage. Well, you know, the debt crisis of the 1980s really collapsed the political unities, the hope from the Third World. But something new has emerged, particularly since the world financial crisis of 2007-2008. The large countries of the South, particularly in Asia, led by China, have developed their manufacturing, they've developed their technological capacity. In terms of the objective changes taking place, we can see that before our eyes. The center of gravity of the world economy is no longer the Atlantic Ocean. It's definitely now in Asia, somewhere between China, Vietnam, Bangladesh, India, Indonesia. These countries are growing at a very fast clip. But the sense of political unity is still not fully visible, despite the BRICS. The BRICS is a trade body. It's not really a political body. It shouldn't be exaggerated. So that sense of Bandung, which was there in 1955, is not there now. We're sort of waiting on the revival of the Bandung spirit. We've got the structures for a new world relatively in place, but we don't really have the consciousness, the confidence that a new world can be built. And by the way,
we have
the
10
consciousness
seconds,
in the North is not there either.
We have 10 seconds.
Yeah, I'm just saying the consciousness in the northern countries not there either as of yet. Trump's tariffs trying to reverse this trend, not going to work.
We have to leave it.